You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. And I'm so excited about our show today because Desiree Mays is going to be back talking about the Santa Fe Opera. But first, we're just going to hear a few words from our beloved sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you in part by Total Wine and More. With their new location in Santa Fe, they can enhance your summer dinners, barbecues, and brunch parties. They make it easy with their famous in-store tasting bar. For example, you can taste a delicious Oak Ridge Zinfandel, and for summertime brunch, there's the Rondell Gold Brut Cava, which is such a good sparkling wine for mimosas. Total Wine and More has a location in Albuquerque, and their new Santa Fe store is on Zafirano. You can go to totalwine.com for in-store pickup, too. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. And thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And the Radio Cafe is brought to you today by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. After a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies but very little moisture, the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. That's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And thanks to the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you want to sponsor the Radio Cafe, you can contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can also call 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican and find all that information there. And now to our program. And we're talking today about the Santa Fe Opera's upcoming season, and I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Desiree Mays. She's an international speaker on opera. She worked with the Santa Fe Opera for many years. She gave lectures at the Cantina. She's author of 18 books on opera in the Opera Unveiled series. She currently lectures for the Metropolitan Opera in New York City and the Los Angeles and San Francisco operas. Welcome.
Hello, Marisha. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. Now, opening night for the Santa Fe Opera is the 29th of June. They're opening with the opera Candide. And this summer season is really quite exciting. There are some traditional operas, and there are some unusual pieces. One of them is Dr. Atomic by the composer John Adams, librettist Peter Sellars, and Peter Sellars is also director of Dr. Atomic, and with any luck, we might even be able to talk to him this summer.
Yes, that would be great.
And Dr. Atomic being performed practically in the sight line of the birthplace of the atomic bomb.
Exactly.
I hate to call it birthplace when it's a weapon of mass destruction, but anyway, it's about the testing of the first atomic bomb. Tell us a little bit about this opera and about, I mean, here we are, 1945, 2018, all these years later.
And we're still dealing with the issue of what this all means. What does it imply? The question that's raised in the opera, I think, is about the dark night of the soul of Oppenheimer, the physicist, and the team who created this extraordinary feat of science, the mystery of this piece, which is so extraordinary, and then realized the moral and ethical questions of what were they doing? Did it end the war? The war was actually over by the time they dropped the bomb. One forgets that. You know, Germany had surrendered. It was done. And yet that was one of the questions that came up, that Edward Teller, one of the scientists in the Manhattan Project, and some others, Leo Szilard, asked of President Truman, do we need to be doing this? And a number of the scientists at the lab actually signed a petition, and that's in the opera. Must we do this? And if we are going to do it, should we not give a demonstration to the Japanese first of what this actually means? Because they probably have no idea. Nobody did. And the answer was no, it needed to be done. In fact, there's one really, you know, makes your hair rise, one scene in the opera where Oppenheimer's come back from Washington, D.C., and they've been deciding which cities to hit. I mean, what an awesome and awful responsibility to be looking at cities of another country and wondering which one shall we take out.
Which one shall we vaporize every single human being and other life form
that's right.
in that city?
Yeah, and that's the moral question, but the decision was to go ahead. So how did one get from the history of the atomic bomb and into an opera? It's an amazing story, which of course Peter Sellers is the one who really brought it to life. When he was working on another opera here some years ago, he kept disappearing to go up to the lab because he was already having an idea of doing an opera along these lines. And as time has gone on, there are now declassified documents from that time period. We're talking June and July of 1945. The opera is set, and the second act, in July 1945, when they did the first test.
The Trinity test.
The Trinity test, yeah, at Alamogordo, down at White Sands, to see. And nobody knew what would happen. I mean, there's a very tense, nail-biting moment, those last moments of this opera, where nobody knows quite what this nuclear reaction will do. Will it cause a chain reaction and start something off that could destroy the planet? I mean, they were really that much in the dark. They had absolutely no idea of the radiation hazard. Yeah, it might up the radiation a bit and look what's happened. Or it may fizzle. I mean, it may not work at all. It may kill every scientist who is in the vicinity here.
But
it
let's
was an
try.
Unknown. Yeah, well, they did everything they could. Oppenheimer was sure. He felt that he really, this was a man of great integrity, that he would not have just set something off that he didn't really believe in was could be contained and do what it was supposed to do, which is, of course, what happened.
Well, and there's documentation that is still coming out and still being released by journalists and documentary filmmakers and so on about the cancer rates in that area, the number of people who have suffered and died as a result of that test, because they weren't even told. You know, there was like a residue on their laundry that was hanging outside and they brought it in.
Yeah. My first husband, Chuck Mays, was a physicist who did studies with the downwinders, the people who were in southern Utah, who, when the wind went the wrong way, the radioactive fallout came down on them. And I remember going with him once into that area in the south of Utah to watch how the sheep graze, which seems extraordinary. But it turned out his thesis was that the radioactive fallout had come down, gotten into the roots of the grass and the things that the sheep eat. And how close did they crop the ground? How much could these sheep have ingested? Which then, when they were killed, cattle too, how much would they ingest, and would this be passed into the milk chain with cattle? And what were the implications of that? Now, this was in the 60s, 70s, a long time afterwards. The latent period is long. So there are many now studies, I think that is understood. But at the time, they didn't know. Anyway, Peter Sellers goes up to Los Alamos, and he looks into all of these declassified documents. He finds out everything he can about Oppenheimer and the team. Oppenheimer had at one point wanted to be a poet, and there is poetry throughout this entire libretto. In fact, the libretto is more, not much of it is sort of brand new. A lot of it is poetry. It's poetry of Rukeyser, poetry of the Bhagavad Gita, of John Donne, and we're going to play that one incredible aria from the John Donne, the metaphysical poet. And he links all of these pieces along with the declassified information into a story, or really a situation. So the first act that you'll see when curtains don't open here in Santa Fe, but when you see the stage, there's this enormous hanging ball over the stage that's literally hanging over them in every way you can imagine. This is the bomb. They call it the gadget. It was also called Fat Man. They were the names that were used because this was all top secret. Nobody could talk about it. And it's about the interaction of the scientists and the people who are working day and night to bring this about. And they're under some pressure from Washington. General Groves is in charge with Oppenheimer. He's there representing the army who will deploy this weapon. There's a lovely scene with Oppenheimer's wife. She was an intellectual woman and had some real questions about what was going on. He comes home for a change of shirt, you know, a brief few moments, and to a beautiful poem they sing of their love, and he takes a little time out to be with her. There's a child. Their child is in the other bedroom and sometimes cries. There is a Native American woman, Pascualita, who was actually a maid from the San Ildefonso Pueblo. A lot of the support people were from the Pueblos, as you know. Not happily, because they had been sort of dispossessed of their their lands when the whole lab situation was set up. And I think Peter Sellers is really looking into this in this time around of Dr. Atomic. He's looking at the Native American interaction and their presence, which was there. And there's lovely scenes between Kitty Oppenheimer and Pascualita that are part of this. There's a Tewa lullaby sung. And there is a sense of, even though everything will fall apart, life will go on. But nobody actually knew what that meant. So the whole of the first act is in this preparation. It's in the discussions with the scientists, the petition to the president to not drop this bomb. That was denied. And then the second act, everybody's in Alamogordo and they're waiting for the test to happen. And it goes right up to those last final moments. And again, Peter Sellers, the director and librettist, is so good at these tension-making moments. The last moments of the opera are the countdown to the bomb. All you hear is 10 minus 0, 10 minus 1, whatever the countdown is. And it goes down minute by minute. And in the first time I saw this, the opera premiered, sadly not here, but in San Francisco in 2005. The next production was Houston. I saw that. And it's a chilling moment where there's just a countdown and then it ends. And the rest is history, as they say. When it was done at the Met, which is a production many people have seen because it was done as part of the HD screenings, Perry Wilcott was the director, not Peter Sellers, and it was slightly changed in the ending. So I'm really delighted that Peter Sellers is back to do this. This is his piece, and he has a very special personal take on it that we can get into. So maybe we can play that a little of that aria. Would that help people?
Sure, let's play that right now.
We should say, of course, that the most important person in an opera probably is the composer, who is John Adams, who did Nixon in China and The Death of Klinghoffer, two operas that have been very successful, but a very contemporary composer. Those sounds are contemporary and they're not easy. They're dealing with extreme stress here, and you get that sense. But this is a lyrical moment. To me, this is the aria of the entire 20th century. It's called Batter My Heart, and it comes from a John Donne poem. John Donne was a metaphysical poet. This aria is at the moment, the end of the first act, where Oppenheimer, everything is ready. Now they just have to go down to Alamogordo for the test shot. And he's having this terrible moment of realizing the horror of what is about to happen. And the poem by John Donne, in the poem, Donne portrays himself as a city that is captured by the devil, and he's begging God to conquer him. Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet, but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, or throw me and bend your force to break, burn, blow, and make me new. And the singer in this, whom I love, he was so great in this role of Oppenheimer, is Gerald Finley in the original production.
Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as you. But knock, breathe, knock, breathe, knock, breathe, shine and seek to mend. Batter my heart, three-person. Right.
That was the Batter My Heart aria from Dr. Atomic. The character singing it is Robert Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
Batter My Heart, three-person God, refers to the Holy Trinity, and this was called the Trinity Test.
Yeah, that's where Oppenheimer got the name of Trinity, was from his poem. Poems permeate the whole piece. Apparently, he actually spoke Sanskrit in order to be able to read the Bhagavad Gita in the original. This was a very brilliant man. But as time went on, of course, there was the tragedy. The opera doesn't deal with any of this, but he was brought to the Un-American Activities Committee of McCarthy. He was stripped of his clearances and dishonored, which was a tragedy for him, of course, for the man. But the opera ends right in those moments just before the bomb goes off, and they're not sure what's going to happen. So it's very relevant to our time. I mean, that question is still with us. You know, what happens when this goes off? Should we be doing it? The whole moral question, the ethics of it, are as present today as they were then. And the mere thought that anybody might unleash this in phenomenal power is devastating. You think about it. Opera makes you think, and that's good. This one does.
For me, one of the questions is, what gets normalized? So you live in a world where it's considered normal to drop something out of the air that murders a million people in a second. If you had a million cops with a million guns murdering a million people,
mm-hmm.
that would not be normal. But to drop a bomb, that somehow is okay? Like, how do we even talk about this? How do we think about it? How do we have these conversations? And, I mean, a lot of operas, and we'll talk about some of the operas that are also in this season, are about love and betrayal and cads and so on.
Well,
these are the big questions.
This is the real thing, yeah. And I don't think we're really immune to the horrors of the atomic bomb. I mean, when it happened, the entire Earth all agreed, never, never again. And that has gone on. But now, generations later, they're rethinking that.
No, well, actually, Desiree, when it happened, there was great celebration.
Mm.
And everybody thought, what a wonderful thing we've done. And that was all that was in the press. And then a journalist and author named John Hersey went to Hiroshima and wrote a book called Hiroshima. And it was the first piece of literature or journalism to actually say, here are the horrors of it. Here's what happened. And that's when people started, and other things of that nature, people started to say, uh-oh, there's a dark side here. I mean, it was not universally condemned the moment it happened. On the contrary.
No. But once they realized the implication of it, I think there was agreement by all governments that this could not happen again. I've been to Hiroshima, and I've been standing at Ground Zero, and it's a terrifying thing just to think about. It's a tragedy on all fronts. In fact, if people are interested, there's a wonderful book out there called Oppenheimer, A Tragic Intellect by Charles Thorpe that gives a very good objective view of the whole story of what happened out there. So that's the heavy opera of the season, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could talk about this all day, but let's move on to Leonard Bernstein, who was one of the great lights, I think, of the 20th century for sure. And there's an opera called Candide, which is as much really a musical as an opera.
Yeah, this piece started out actually on Broadway. It's become played more often now in opera companies. Leonard Bernstein could do whatever he wanted. He could do musicals. I mean, West Side Story is still with us, played both in musical theater and in opera houses. He was a great classical composer. He was a man who loved jokes, musical jokes. And the way this came to being was, again, interesting. And funnily enough, I find this amazing connection with the Dr. Atomic, in that, again, we run into the Un-American Activities Committee in McCarthyism. His friend, Bernstein's friend, was Lillian Hellman in the 50s, who had run foul of McCarthy and had been called to these committees, and they were going to put an end to her career. And Bernstein and she decided, we're going to take a stand against this. And this whole business of we're making the best of all possible worlds, regardless of what happens, it was a political satire. So in 1950, this piece premiered. It didn't do very well in the beginning, and Lillian Hellman actually pulled out. Since that time, there have been numerous librettists. Many, many people have had a hand in writing the libretto of this piece. Again, being a musical, part of it contains dialogue. There's quite a lot of dialogue between the songs. As you get in a musical, the characters talk and then they burst into song. That is true of this piece as well. So it gives directors tremendous leeway in how they want to do this. This is certainly not being done in a 1950s mode because none of that situation applies to us now. So the dialogue can be brought up to contemporary situations, and I think that will be done. I saw this production at La Scala Milan, where I was lecturing with a David Carson production that was highly political, highly satirical, and very pointed against Jacques Chirac, Putin, Tony Blair, Bush, all of those people. Thank goodness, in my book, we are having Laurent Pelly as the director of our Candide here. Laurent Pelly did the Frog opera many years ago that people loved by Rameau. He also did the Cinderella, Cendrillon, which has just been seen on the Met's HD screenings. He has a wonderfully gentle, sweet French way of taking these stories. He makes the point, but without going for the jugular, if you like. The piece is by Voltaire. You can check that out in the library. It's not much changed. The Voltaire was also in his time having a go at the politics of his time with this idea of we live in the best of all possible worlds. And what does that mean? And they carry that to an extreme. I mean, this opera is over the top. All
satirical.
The way through. Yeah, but fun in the way it's done, because that we know that's not actually the way it is. Robert Carson said that this is a burlesque tragedy, farce, satire, and grotesque with moments of pathos. So there's plenty of good reasons to go and see it, because it's fun. Candide, of course, is the character, the candid character who is honest and naive and innocent and part of a wonderful family. It's a family in the original, a baron and baroness with their daughter Cunegonde, who's a teenager. There's the maid Paquette, and there is this boy, Candide, of undocumented parents. He's not part of the family. And Dr. Pangloss, who is the teacher and the philosopher, who is teaching this idea that we have the best of all possible worlds. When Candide is caught kissing the daughter, he is booted out of the house, and there starts this unbelievable list of horrendous things that happen to him. He's press-ganged into the army, where he is treated brutally. There's a war where everyone dies. He even finds Cunegonde dead, but in the next scene she's come back to life, and she's become a sort of a femme fatale. In that production she was presented as Marilyn Monroe, and all the men were falling at her feet, and he meets with her and they get back together for a little while. So there's a whole series of terrible things that happen. They go to South America, and it's an excuse for a series of little sequences of different political situations. In this earlier production was the Ku Klux Klan and very extreme groups of people that Candide and she get involved with. Finally, of course, they do come together at the end and decide to give, they must accept it. There is no such thing as the best of all possible worlds, and that we must take each day as it comes and make our garden grow. So it ends on this happy note. But in the interim, it's a fun piece. Dr. Pangloss is a wonderful character and a really demanding role for the actor-singer who sings it, because at one point he is narrating as Voltaire. On the side, he is reading the Voltaire, though the whole thing, of course, is in English, because this is a and Bernstein operas in English. And then he becomes a teacher and he becomes a number of other parts. At one point, when Candide believes he's dead, he comes back, he meets this terrible down and out man with a tin nose, and he goes up to him and finds out is his resurrected Pangloss. But Pangloss has had an affair with Paquette and a number of other women and has got syphilis. But he said, how bad can that be? In the best of all possible worlds, we had a wonderful love and it's okay. Finally, even he gets it by the end and realizes, no, it's not that simple. But that's a great role.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't get all that, it's okay.
Yeah, you don't need to know the story on this piece.
You don't need to know the story, because on many levels, it's a spectacle, and it's as much about the spectacle and the music as it is about following those details of the story. But luckily, there's also those wonderful titles when you go to the opera. Mm. On the chair in front of you, on the back of the chair in front of you, you can read along with what's happening. And even when it's in English, the English is there.
Yeah.
Because you can't always understand
Yeah, especially when it's in English, because these operas, this one is written in English, but an Italian, German, French opera is not written in English. It's a translation, which makes it very hard for the singers. There are certain sounds and vowels at these, you know, extreme high or low levels that are hard to manage, so you cannot follow easily what the English is. So there's always titles there if you need it. But I always tell people, at least know the story before you go to an opera. If you know the story and the relationships, then you're not trying to figure it out as you're sitting watching. You have this issue of, you know, if you're trying to read titles throughout, it becomes more of an intellectual exercise. If you turn the titles off and know the story, the music will tell you the story. The music will also often tell you more than the titles will. If a couple are having an argument, it may look like they hate each other, but really they're in love, and the music will tell you this. I mean, there's all this sort of thing going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. I always look at the titles, though. Mm. That's part of the experience that I have, because it makes it, for me personally, more like theater. And I like seeing opera as a kind of theater, especially because in the Santa Fe Opera in particular, but I think it's a trend around the world, the actors are ever better actors. Mm. They're chosen not only for their great singing, but also for their ability to really do the role and yep. be believable in the role. And the staging and the sets and the props and the lighting and the entire production design are fantastic.
Yeah, it's changed a lot over the years. When I was a child, it was all about the day of the singer. I mean, you went to an opera for the singer or for the conductor.
Right.
Now you go for the director, actually. And that is a plus and a minus. If you hate what the director's doing, you know, you're not going to be happy. But I agree. I mean, the standard of staging of what is being done of these young artists, their training is so amazing these days. They don't just think, they have to do everything else. I sat and watched just last month a masterclass at Carnegie Hall with Joyce DiDonato, and the way she worked with these singers, there were so many facets of what they had to be able to do. They do not just sing and be a voice. That's what it used to be. If you had a great voice, you could just stand and sing, and that would get you by. Not today. Every muscle of their body has to be reacting or reacting. She makes them think it through emotionally, what they're singing about. And lo and behold, I mean, you could hear the difference in half an hour of her working with a singer who thinks he has it right in the beginning, and then she's worked with him half an hour. And yeah, this sort of training is phenomenal. And there are hundreds and over 1,000 young people auditioned to come to the Santa Fe Opera. If they have been here as an apprentice, it looks so good on their resume. It'll open all sorts of doors for them. And for many of them, they have leaped from being a member of the apprentice program to taking on big roles here. They understudy the principals, and one thing leads to another and a number. In fact, Joyce herself, many, many years, was an apprentice here, and look at what has happened to her career. She's a superstar now.
We have been talking about Candide, and do we want to hear just a little piece of music from Candide?
Yes, let's hear a little of this great thesis. We still use this, the best of all possible worlds. You'll hear a little bit from the different members of the class. This opens the show where Dr. Pangloss is giving them this lesson, and some of the other characters will join in.
Let us review lesson 11,
paragraph 2. Axiom 7.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Reclassify pigeons and camels.
Pigeons can fly.
Camels are mammals.
But there is a reason for everything under the sun.
There is a season for everything under the sun.
Objection! What about snakes?
Snakes. 'Twas snake that tempted Mother Eve. Because of snake we now believe that though depraved, we can be saved from hellfire and damnation.
Because of snake's temptation.
If snake had not seduced our lot and pranged us for salvation, Jehovah could not pardon all the sins that we call cardinal, involving bed and bottle.
Now on to Aristotle.
Mankind is one, all men are brothers.
As you have done, do unto others.
It's understood in this best of all possible worlds.
All's for the good in this best of all possible worlds.
Objection! What about war?
War. The war may seem a bloody curse, it is a blessing in reverse. When cannons roar, both rich and poor by danger are united,
till every wrong is righted.
Philosophers make evident the point that I have cited. 'Tis war makes equal, as it were, the noble and the commoner. Thus war improves relations.
Now on to conjugations.
Ammo, a mass, amat, amamus.
Ammo, a mass, amat, amamus.
Knowing that this is the best of all possible worlds,
with love and kisses, the best of all possible worlds.
Cordera demonstrandum.
That was from Candide, The Best of All Possible Worlds, and that was from a 2012 New York Philharmonic production of Candide with Kristen Chenoweth, Jeff Blumenkrantz, Paul Groves, and Janine LaManna. And you can definitely hear the Broadway in that.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, Bernstein's having fun in this, but there are lovely moments of pathos. He's a master craftsman in terms of theatre, sort of like Puccini was. I mean, some of these great production people really understand what's necessary in a theatre. Puccini was another man. I mean, he had a real feel for what would and wouldn't work in a theatre. So we are presenting again, Madame Butterfly.
Now, that was here several years ago.
Yes.
I remember you and I talked about it.
Yeah, we did. It's the same production. It was a beautiful production. And again, Madame Butterfly can't miss. And even though I have worked with this numerous times, and when I hear someone ask me to give a talk and I say, oh, yes, what's the opera Butterfly? I think, oh, I don't know. And then, you know, I start working on it. The magic works every single time. If you saw this every couple of years, it wouldn't be too much. So there are some great sopranos singing. We have actually two who are sharing the role. Kelly Cadus, who will be singing all of July, and Ana Maria Martinez, whose career is soaring now too, will be singing Madame Butterfly, Cho-Cho-San in August. This production is by John Fiore, and as I said, it is one we've seen before. But, you know, Marichal, there's no way any opera company can mount five new productions. The mere fact that we do five productions in Santa Fe is nothing short of miraculous.
Yeah.
And still manage to keep our heads above sinking and staying in the black. This opera company does a superb job along those lines. And Butterfly sells tickets. People love the story of the Japanese girl who makes a brief marriage to an American lieutenant whose ship is in port for a brief time.
Talk about total cads.
Yeah, well, he is. Really, yeah, he makes, though in, I suppose not in his defense, but he signs a contract with a marriage broker that says that he'll be married for 999 years or he can get out of it in with a 30-day announcement. That's
yeah,
it.
He has 30 days to return the product if he doesn't like it,
exactly.
which he doesn't tell her.
He doesn't want to fuss with the details. Now, in one of the earlier stories about this butterfly story by John Luther Long, he actually took a real story, and a naval officer arrived in the port of Nagasaki and had one of these arranged marriages with Madame Chrysanthème. But Madame Chrysanthème, she's a teenager, and there are no such things as prostitutes in Japan. I mean, this was a closed society, and they were appalled at the way all of these foreigners arrived at port and wanted to party with their girls. So this whole marriage custom became a way of dealing with it. While they were in port, they would have a wife and a home, and tragically, of course, children were born of these marriages and are abandoned. I mean, that's still going. It goes on in every war, in Vietnam, or look at all the children who were born in this very situation. But with Madame Chrysanthème, she knew, this youngster knew what was going on. She knew it would be a temporary arrangement, she would be a wife for a short time, and then he'd vanish till the next one came. In fact, the last scene of that story is wonderful. The naval officer goes back to the apartment they had shared, and he hears this little clinking sound, and he listens at the door. She's singing a little song, and he opens it a crack to look in. And here is Madame Chrysanthème sitting in the middle of the floor, picking up his silver coins and tapping them with a little mallet to see that they are real. This is the money he had paid her for the time they had been together. Now, Butterfly knows nothing of this. Cho-Cho-San makes the mistake. She falls totally in love. She has a child. She believes 2 years later that Pinkerton is coming back to her. And he does come back. but he comes back with his American wife. And this was what happened. These men would go home, they'd have a family, they'd come back, and when he heard about the child, he's come back to take the child. So that last harrowing scene of Madame Butterfly is where she's waited all night through the amazing humming chorus for his return, not knowing. And then when he does come with this strange woman, she realizes. So she says to Pinkerton, she says, come back in half an hour and you may have your son. And in that time, she takes down her father's sword and commits suicide. So when he arrives, she is lying dead on the floor with the two-year-old child waiting for his father. It's a tragic, tragic story.
But the music is amazing.
Music is amazing. It's Puccini. Puccini knew very little about Japan, I promise you. in those days, you just had to have a flavor. People loved the exoticism of the East. It was unknown. And he picked up what he could. The American National Anthem is actually in there at one point, where Pinkerton with the American consul drinks a toast to Pinkerton's future when he has a real American wife. There's also some Japanese pieces in there, that Japanese national anthem, which upset people in the beginning. Now everyone's got over this, but it's a very beautiful visual piece, and it can be done very exotically with a gorgeous kimono and a fantasy piece. This production is a little bit more down to earth. It's at a time where electricity is just coming into being, so it's not all lit by candlelight. There's electrical wires and things, so it's a little bit more realistic, and I think one gets a sense of the tragedy. But that's Puccini at his best, and that's always a big hit. People love that piece.
Now, there are two more pieces, and maybe we can talk about them briefly. Maybe hear one more piece of music. The Italian Girl in Algiers is by Gioachino Rossini, and Ariadne auf Naxos is by Richard Strauss. Talk just a little bit about these two operas.
Well, The Italian Girl in Algiers, L'Italiana in Algerie, in Italian by Rossini. He wrote it when he was 21 years of age, which is amazing. This man was becoming so famous and churning out three or four operas at a time, which was sort of extraordinary. In those days, you know, they never played the same opera twice. You had to come up with a whole new opera each season. And with Rossini, under these sort of pressures, he would take the pieces that worked well in the last opera would go into the next one, sometimes regardless of whether they were comedy or tragedy. But this one is pure comedy, again, in a sort of an exotic setting where this girl, young woman, Isabella, is shipwrecked off the coast of Algiers. And the Mustafa, who is the local ruler, absorbs her into his harem, which you would think is a fate worse than death. But this is an incredible woman. Rossini loved women, and he loved mezzo-sopranos. So most of his leading ladies are mezzos, not sopranos, as this one is. And she is a totally emancipated woman. She regards the whole thing as a bit of a farce. When she sees the ridiculous Mustafa, she laughs, and she gives him a hard time. At the same time, on the same shipwreck, her young lover Lindoro has been shipwrecked, and he becomes a slave of Mustafa. There's another character, Taddeo, who she introduces as her uncle. But these three men are all in love with Isabella. And the whole point of the opera is it's the shenanigans that goes on and how they escape. The escape then took on a sort of a historical role, I suppose, because the Austrians were in control of Italy at the time. And she rounds up the Italians from the ship, the shipwrecked men, and she says she will lead them back to the ship and to freedom, which of course she does. And there's a big nationalistic aria, which the Italians of the time loved, which we missed the point of completely. but in the aria I'd like to play for you now, Cruda Sorte is near the beginning when she appears, and she's sort of amused by the whole scenario and completely confident that she's going to be able to handle this, which of course she does. She is the one who leads the men to safety while they're all quaking in their boots, and Mustafa is left looking a little bit silly. So let's play this piece. The singer on this is Marilyn Horne. This was one of her great roles.
Sì, come si fa? sono tutti simili a questo poco, siete molto poco, sono tutti simili a questo poco. Tutti la chiedono, tutti la bravano, tutti la chiedono, tutti la bravano.
And that was from The Italian Girl in Algiers. And, you know, you can't go wrong with Rossini. Every time they do a Rossini opera at the Santa Fe Opera, it's always not just great music, but it's so much fun.
It's fun. He winds you up. I mean, the famous crescendos, he starts very soft and he builds and he builds. And it's always fun. You come out laughing, which is good. I mean, Candide will do this too. Dr. Atomic won't.
Right.
Now, Ariadne auf Naxos is yet another unusual piece. It's by Richard Strauss, and we are, in many ways, a Richard Strauss theatre. John Crosby always presented Strauss. Ariadne auf Naxos was an experimental piece between Strauss and his librettist Hugo von Hofmannsthal, where they wanted to combine theatre with opera, which turned out to be a disaster. So they took a play by Molière, Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme, and they played that first, and then they were going to have a little incidental music by Strauss, and then they were going to tack on or present a short version of the story of Ariadne from Greek mythology. Turned out what really the bottom line with this was the audience who loved theatre hated the opera, and the people who loved opera hated the play.
Right.
There's still a bit of that. You know, I'm always surprised that with this crossover issue, people go to opera or ballet, symphony or theatre. And they're doing better now, I think, generally, that people are more open to trying, you know, other forms of art.
Fusion, crossover.
Right, and why not? I mean, Candide is a piece, it's a musical comedy and an opera. This also sort of crosses those two worlds as well, because the first act is pure farce. It's backstage with where all the artists are getting ready in the dressing rooms of a very wealthy man. This is set in a Viennese mansion, of course, and he's planning a fabulous dinner. He's going to have this big dinner, then there's going to be the play, and then there's going to be fireworks, and then the opera. The whole thing doesn't work out that way because the dinner overruns, the king carries on, and it goes on way too long. So they have to combine the what is to be the opera, which is part commedia dell'arte and part straight opera, dramatic opera. So the first act is set backstage where all the actors are getting together. The Zerbinetto, who is a commedia dell'arte, sort of Harlequin, Pirro characters, who are the comedians and happy-go-lucky, and they can improvise. They don't mind how they present what they're doing. And then there is Ariadne, who is a very serious dramatic diva who has been abandoned by Theseus on her island in the story, and she just wants death and dying. And the two women confront each other. At this point they hate each other because the diva wants to know what this stupid woman is doing, you know, backstage. And so there's all about the confrontation. The main character that stands out, the first act, is the composer, which could well be Richard Strauss himself. He's being told he has to cut his piece, there isn't time for it, they don't like this, they don't like that, and he's distraught. You know, the great aria here is music is the highest art, and he's trying to present this and no one's listening. So this goes on and it's sort of chaos in the first act. The second act then is played straight. This is as the opera would go out to the aristocratic dinner. It starts out with Ariadne. She comes out of her cave and she's mourning the loss of Theseus, whom she saved. Remember, this was the woman who gave Theseus the string that led him out of the maze with the Minotaur.
Right.
That's the Greek story. And he's abandoned her now and she just wants death. And into the midst of this comes Urbaneta, because time is short, they have to combine the two, the comedy and the opera, which is a recipe for disaster. And Urbaneta's attitude is, what's your problem, lady? You know, one goes, there'll be somebody else in his place. You surrender and go with the flow. And Ariadne is saying, no, I loved him, only death. And of course, the way that the whole thing gets resolved is the god Bacchus sails to the island, and she thinks he is Hermes, the messenger of death. He's not, and the two of them are attracted to each other, and sure enough, she does surrender to the next god that comes along, and Zerbinette is left saying, I told you so. It's very cute, and it's very human, and it's very different. So again, if you want a really entertaining night of the opera, that's the one to go for.
So we've got everything from weapons of mass destruction to decadent party animals in Vienna.
Mm-hmm. That's yes, absolutely.
And
that's
everything
the
in between.
Everything in between. Little Japan thrown in, Algiers, and you know. But that's the strength. I mean, this, you know, the stories are the same, Mary Shaw. There are stories. I don't care how you dress them up or what time or age or place you set them in. If you really get below the surface, I mean, it's pure entertainment on one level, at the easiest level, but dig a little deeper. These are our stories. These are our relationships. This is a woman, Mustafa, who's domineering a woman who does not want to be bossed around and who breaks out and who tells him. You know, this is very, very contemporary. They all are. Hopefully the butterfly story is not happening too often, and yet we're having wars as we speak where the conquering army is raping or maybe hopefully in some cases falling in love with the native women and making them pregnant and then abandoning children. The issues are still there. They're very human issues. And the big one, of course, the overwhelming one in this season is the question of the ethics and morality of building a bomb that's going to destroy people. We should be getting together, not destroying one another. So if opera makes us think about these things, I think it's well worthwhile.
You can find out much more at santafeopera.org, and you can get your tickets, and there's all kinds of good things like backstage tours, and people go tailgating, and there's family nights, and there's ways to go inexpensively, and there's ways to bring the kids. So it's all there at the Santa Fe Opera.
Yeah, I really encourage people. This house is so unique, partly because of where it and what it is. This open theater up on the hill above Santa Fe, where we bring in 2,000 people a night for 8 weeks, is amazing. And so many things. Go early. Go and have either a box meal there or tailgate, or go to the pavilion where you can have a beautiful dinner, and there's lectures, preview lectures, backstage tours, all sorts of stuff. Go early, wander the grounds and get a sense of what it's about. I believe with all theatre, one should get there early and leave your life outside in the car park. You know, no matter what you bring to the theatre, it's hard when you've been working all day. I used to do this in D.C. and I was reviewing the opera, Washington Opera. I'd work all day and then I'd rush to the theatre and have to leave it behind and just sit. That's what overtures are for. To get you into the space and to allow yourself the freedom, I suppose, to let go, to become part of it. Because often you can empathize with the characters. They may be your situation or they may be the situation of someone you know. I think opera promotes great empathy because there are people in these situations, may never be your situation, but you know of people's hurt and it's a way of dealing with it.
And I think there's a kind of nice paradox, which is, in a sense, there's nothing more artificial and stylized than opera.
Right.
It's the most unrealistic art form you can possibly imagine. And at the same time, it deals with some of the most universal themes that you can relate to. And my sort of breakthrough opera was La Traviata, which I remember going to opening night in 2009 and coming home and thinking the themes in this opera are as real now as they've ever been, and they're very, and it's just, you could say the same thing for, as we've talked about, the this year's operas. So there we have it, and I wanted to ask you before we go, Desiree, what have you been up to? You've been a shining presence with the Santa Fe Opera for so many years.
I know, 20 years I lectured at the Cantina, which was an amazing experience.
But you're not doing that now, and there's other wonderful lecturers there, and so people should definitely go to the pre-opera lectures at the Santa Fe Opera. But what are you up to? You're definitely not retired.
No way, no. Actually, it's rather nice now. I have a little more freedom. And when I take on operas now to lecture about, I have more time to do the research and take a little more time over it, which I really love doing. I'm speaking for the Metropolitan Opera once or twice a year for Los Angeles and San Francisco. For instance, the Met, they just asked me to do a three-hour seminar all on my own on Cinderella, Cendrillon. And when I heard that, I thought, how could I talk for 3 hours about Cinderella? Actually, it turned out it was quite wonderful, starting with the fact that there are 700 versions of the Cinderella tale, so I was not about to run out of material, right?
Right, right.
Going all the way back.
And they're really different.
Oh, yeah, all the way back to Egypt was the first one, and then China, and then the motifs of fairy tale, folk tale. How do you get from fairy tale to myth? I drew heavily on Joseph Campbell for this, the power of myth, and his take is that, well, myth is a grown-up version of children's fairy tales. You can't give a child a myth to deal with, but yes, folk and fairy tale you can. So starting with that, currently I'm off to San Francisco to talk about The Ring. They're doing the full cycle. I'll be lecturing every night in the theater before the show, which is always nice, and it's indoors. It is sort of nice, too.
The Ring, which we never do in Santa Fe because it's so long and there's not enough oxygen.
Well, yeah, and you need 90-plus musicians in the pit. That's a challenge, too. But hopefully one day one of the earlier operas could be done here, and it would be quite magical, and I keep hoping. But I'm focusing more and more on Wagner because, as you say, you know, characters don't speak to one another. They sing. Sometimes our emotions are beyond words. That's something that Wagner understood. And the key points of The Ring Cycle, which is 16 hours of music over four operas, he abandons words entirely, spoken, never spoken, but not sung either, and just composes music, because music speaks to us once we're set up for that situation. So that'll be fun to go to San Francisco. So I'm doing lectures. I do moderate panels. I write for opera, working freelance, but not all the time, which is nice. I now have time for my friends, which I had not got so much time for before. I'm not rushing from one thing to another. This is Santa Fe, you know, and I think we run into that terrible grinding wheel of getting busier and busier while we live in this place, which is supposed to be laid back and calm. And yoga helps, I must say. You know? So, in fact, the next opera lecture I'll be giving for the Met is an interesting topic. They asked me to talk about the role of religion in opera. Not spirituality, religion. So that'll be very interesting. And when I looked at the repertoire for next season, maybe 9 out of the 10 operas that the Met is doing have religion one way or another about them. With Wagner, I have to include him because that's whom I talk about a lot. He thought he was his own god, so I can talk about him in terms of that. Very interesting. The topics are wonderful. They're philosophical. They're so instructive. I mean, I'm learning so much about the world of customs and cultures and people and geography, history, all of that. So it's a very rewarding career to have, I must say.
The Santa Fe Opera box office is reachable at 1-800-280-4654. And if you're calling in Santa Fe, it's 505-986-5900. Also, santafeopera.org. Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us. It's nice to have. It's sort of like a little reunion.
I know. We did 5 operas in an hour instead of 5 hours.
I know. We used to take 5 separate shows, 5 hours, 1 opera each show. But this was great. And thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me back.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.